In this part of the Suffering and Deliverance series, we're going to look at the prophet Daniel. We're going to see that Daniel was delivered twice in his life. We're going to look at both of those. The first one is more brief, and then the second one, of course, is the one that everybody knows about, that is being delivered from the lion's den. But Daniel was also delivered as a young man, as a youth, when he was serving in the kingdom of Babylon, when he was carried there captive. If you turn to Daniel chapter 1 and verses 3 through 7, you're going to see here that Daniel, because of his skill and wisdom and his cunning knowledge, that he was chosen by the king of Babylon to stand before him and to serve in his kingdom. Daniel 1, 3 through 7 says, "And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning, and knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning of the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego." So Daniel and these boys were chosen because of their wisdom, their education, and we'll look at that here in just a second. Obviously they were trained, but they were clearly diligent as well. It takes a lot of diligence, it takes a lot of work to learn the things that they knew. They were skillful in wisdom. That just doesn't come to you by laying your Bible under your pillow at night and just hoping. They were cunning in knowledge. They'd acquired a lot of information in their lives. They knew a lot of things. They understood science. Science means knowledge, so not just chemistry and physics or whatever. They understood. They had a good understanding of the knowledge of how the world works. They had the ability to stand in the king's palace, which means that they were proper, they had manners, they had respect, they had social etiquette, right? They learned things. These were educated children. And they wanted them so they could teach them the learning in the tongues of the Chaldeans. So they wanted to be able to teach them another language. They could see that these boys had what it took. And it reminds me of Proverbs 22 and verse 29, which says, "Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean or average or base men." Probably the rest of their buddies that they went to school with were all digging ditches or something in Babylon, but not these boys. They were diligent in their business and they stood before kings. That's a good lesson for all of us, which that's kind of one of the lessons we'll get to at the end of this section. So Daniel was a man of principle and conviction, and he purposed in his heart not to defile himself with the king's meat. Remember, they were supposed to give them a portion of meat for, 3 years? And then afterwards they were going to see how they all looked. Well, Daniel couldn't eat that meat, because whatever that meat was, it was something that was forbidden to him. Could have been pork, could have been seafood, could have been any number of things that the Jews were not allowed to eat. Or it could have just been something that Daniel had a personal conviction about. But anyway, he wouldn't do it. Daniel 1 and verse 8. "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat." Meat means food, not necessarily just flesh. "Nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself." I don't want to get to all, I'm seeing all the lessons here, but I don't want to draw the lessons out yet. I'll wait to cover the lessons here in a minute. So he worked out a deal with the prince of the eunuchs to eat pulse and drink water for 10 days and then be examined. Pulse is the edible seeds of leguminous plants cultivated for food as peas, beans, lentils, etc. So he was on some kind of a vegetarian diet, but he was getting his protein too, because he's getting the beans and the lentils and things like that. Verses 9 through 14. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. This is what happens when you seek God. You're brought into favor with God and man. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. The king sees you guys not looking as well as the other ones, and he finds that you've been eating this pulse stuff. He's going to be upset. I'm going to be in trouble too. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. That was a good compromise. Give us 10 days. We don't need the whole 3 years. Just give us 10 days. After 10 days, if we look good, if we look better than them, then let us continue to eat what we're eating. And the king probably won't care. All the king really wants is results, after all. So at the end of 10 days, Daniel and his friends were in better shape than those who had eaten the king's food. They're in verse 15. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. You see, it always pays to obey God. The king's meat may have tasted good. The king's meat may have, by all of the wisdom of the people of that day, the king's meat might have been a far greater diet. But God said, eat this stuff and don't eat that stuff. And they said, well, we're going to eat what God said. And we don't care what men says. We don't care what anybody else says. So from then on, Daniel was able to eat his diet for the remainder of that time, that 3 years. Verse 16, thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. Now, you know what most people would have done in this situation. What would most people have done? They would have eaten the king's meat. They would have just done what they were told. Who cares what God says? This is what I have to do. This is what I was told. If I don't do this, I'm going to be in trouble. Most people, that's what they would have done. But not Daniel. Because of his wisdom and understanding, Daniel served in the government of the Babylonian Empire until the Medes and the Persians conquered it. So for many years, verses 17 through 21. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them, and among them all was found none, like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. So there are some lessons that we can learn from this story. And when I say story, I mean factual account. The word story doesn't mean a made-up thing. It just means an account of something. There's some lessons we can learn. It looks like about 7 of them. Number 1, it pays to focus on gaining understanding and wisdom at a young age. That's when you are most easily able to learn. Unfortunately, most people, most kids, waste their youth. I was one of them. Wasted my youth, wasted my teenage years, or just about all of them, maybe the last couple. I didn't as much. But most kids just waste. They waste their youth. All that time they could have spent learning and acquiring knowledge and wisdom and skills and becoming a man or a woman and learning how to do life well. Most kids just pee it all away. They just waste it. It's sad. I did too. I wish I had my youth back. I wish I would have read books when I was a kid. I could have read, I mean, when I was a teenager, I could have read, I don't know, dozens of books. I could have learned all kinds of stuff. Had a lot better base to start off with, but I didn't start getting wise until my 20s, early 20s, thank the Lord. But anyway, it's a pace to focus on gaining understanding and wisdom at a young age. They ended up serving the king instead of digging ditches. Lesson number two. It is important to make sure your children, especially your sons, get a quality education, which will open up opportunities for them in the future. Now, by quality education, I don't mean college degree necessarily. That I have said that before. That can be useful in very limited circumstances these days. But I mean a real quality education. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but I talked about that in Preparing Your Kids for the Real World, that whole series I spent like 3 months talking about. It pays because I don't know whoever the parents were of these four boys, their parents obviously did a good job. I highly doubt these kids were just on their own accord seeking wisdom and knowledge and studying and all that. Their parents obviously did a good job. And guess what? Their kids were serving the king, not digging ditches. Not that there's anything wrong with digging ditches, but I think you get what I'm saying. Lesson number three. If you work hard and set your eyes on being wise, the Lord will promote you, even when in a state of captivity. You notice, you remember these guys, they were wise to begin with, and that's why they were looked at for promotion in the first place. And then they were promoted, and just in the passage we just read there, they continued to gain skill and understanding and knowledge all along. So if you work hard and set your eyes on being wise, the Lord will promote you. Lesson number four. With every advancement in our lives, there will be challenges to prove us if we will fear God and keep His commandments, or if we will compromise to get by. Because here was an advancement for them. Right? They had spent years of their youth learning and gaining knowledge and understanding and wisdom, and now they have this great opportunity to stand before the king, to serve in the highest echelons of the government. And with this advancement, there comes a challenge. They have to choose. Am I going to obey the king and am I going to eat the food that he wants me to eat? Or am I going to eat what God told me to eat? Or am I going to eat what my conscience and my convictions tell me that I must eat? Or am I just going to compromise to get by? Like I said, what would most people do? Most people would say, well, it's just food. Yeah, God probably won't care. I'll just eat whatever the king says to eat. Because after all, it'd be really nice to be serving with the king and not down here, you know, cleaning out the dunghill or whatever the other jobs might have been. So everybody's going to have this. As you go through life and you progress and opportunities come about, mark it. With every opportunity, there will be a challenge and you will have to decide, will I obey God or will I obey men? Will I compromise? Remember Daniel when you have that opportunity. Lesson number five. It's always best to try diplomacy first when faced with a confrontation. Remember how Daniel handled that? Daniel didn't shake his fist at the prince of the eunuchs and say, look here, I'm not eating your food. I don't care what you say. He didn't act like that. He humbly asked. He requested. He tried to do what he could to have a peaceful solution to this. And it worked out quite well, didn't it? Now, sometimes diplomacy doesn't work, but it should be first tried. And that in our personal lives, of course, with nations, that diplomacy should always be tried first. The U.S.'s idea of diplomacy is, we'll give you a chance before we go to war. Either you do all these impossible things and totally bow down and surrender to us and become our vassal, or else we'll bomb you into the Stone Age. That's the U.S. idea of diplomacy. Lesson number six. if we hold fast to our convictions, even when we are opposed by the will of the king or the will of the government, God will bless us and deliver us. It can be a little scary, but you got to remember Daniel. Daniel held fast to his convictions, and Daniel didn't care. I get the impression here that if the prince of the eunuchs would have said, "I'm sorry, you got to eat the king's meat," Daniel would have said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not." He would have done what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Well, that's what the four of them, they were there. I mean, we know what the three of them did later on, right? That's what they would have done. But, you know, they held fast to those convictions, and God blessed them and delivered them. You just remember that, especially in these times that we live in. You hold fast to your convictions, because we've already been through it a couple of years ago, and we'll probably be through it again. And you know what? When we held fast to our convictions 2 years ago, what happened? Nothing. We kept on meeting, and we didn't have any trouble. God delivered us. He blessed us because we held to our convictions, and we just kept having church, and we didn't care what they said. Lesson number 7. If we hold to our principles, we will be recognized and promoted by men. You know, let's face it. Decent men love men of principle. Even if they don't agree with their principles, decent men love men of principles. I know I do. I mean, you take a guy that I don't agree with, whatever his principle might be, and I see a guy standing up on his principles and suffering for his principles and saying, "Nope, I won't do it. I don't care what you say. I don't care what you're going to do to me. I am not going to give in." I respect that man, even if I deplore whatever he's standing for. And people are like that. You will be promoted and recognized by men when you hold to your principles. Now, the problem is most people don't have principles. And that's a fact. I mean, most people today do not have principles. I mean, they have one principle that I'm going to do whatever I want, or I'm going to do whatever will get me by, or, you know, that's their principle, which is no principle at all. Most people don't have principles. Now, you say, "Well, that's terrible. Why would you say that about people?" 2020. Look at 2020. What happened? They tell you to lock down. They tell you to stay at home. They tell you to close your churches down, close your business down, wear your mask, obey, social distance. And what did almost everybody in this nation do? Exactly what they were told. Because there's a virus out there. Oh, it's scary. We might die. We might get sick. Most people don't have principles. See, if you have principles, you didn't need to know in 2020 that this was a fake pandemic. You didn't need to know that if you had principles. You didn't need to know that it wasn't a fraction as deadly as they told us it was going to be. You didn't need to know that. You didn't need to know that masks are completely worthless and do nothing to stop the spread of respiratory viruses. You didn't need to know that if you have principles. You didn't need to know that the vaccines are deadly and worthless or worse when it comes to preventing COVID. You didn't need to know any of that stuff if you have principles. You didn't need to know that locking everybody down in their home will do nothing to stop the spread of a virus, which Johns Hopkins just released a study just the other, you know, a week ago or so that showed us that the lockdowns did nothing. If you have principles, if you understand the principles of liberty, You didn't need to know any of that stuff. All you needed to have was principles to say, "No, I don't care if it's dangerous. I don't care if it's deadly. I'm not doing all this stuff because you have no right to tell me to do that." If you have principles. The problem is nobody has principles, especially when it comes to true principles of liberty and freedom. Nobody understands any of that anymore. That was lost decades ago, generations ago. People do. They will respect you when you have principles. But honestly, because nobody has principles and nobody stands up for principle anymore, it is so rare that people have a hard time even getting their mind around and grasping the idea that somebody actually has principles that they'll stand on. I'll give you an example out of my own life. Set and I went down to the hospital earlier this week, last week, to meet with the financial counselors to see if we could get a discount for being cash payers, for being self-payers, essentially. And I'm fine with getting discounts. I mean, it's exorbitantly priced. It's totally ridiculous. And I'm fine with anybody out of the goodness of their heart giving me a discount if they'd like to. So we went down there and we met with the one, with the lady, the counselor. And she said the policy was now that everybody has to apply for Medicaid before you can even take the next step. Before they'll even look at you to see if you qualify or for financial assistance or anything, everybody has to apply for Medicaid. I said, I'm sorry, I can't. I cannot apply for Medicaid because my principles and my convictions will not allow me to take money from the government. And she just looked at me like I had two heads and said, oh, okay, well, she can do it, pointing to my wife. I said, no, we're married. We both hold these principles. No, we can't. Okay, well, let me talk to my boss. And she goes and talks to the boss and comes back. She's like, no, I'm sorry. That's all. You have to apply for Medicaid. But we can go ahead and do it. And I mean, you might get it. And I'm like, I don't think you're hearing me here. I don't care if I could get it. I don't care if I qualify. I don't know if I qualify. It doesn't matter. I can't take it. I won't take it. I won't apply for it. That was very nice, very respectful. She's like, and you can just see like the hurt in her eyes almost, like, oh, I feel so bad for you. And yeah, I mean, she did. And it was just like, I'm sure she's blown away. Like, she's probably never met somebody that, oh, the government's handing out free money. Oh, sure, sign me up. So, and then she tried a third time. She's like, well, I mean, you might be surprised. You might actually be able to qualify. Like, I don't think you're understanding. I can't do it. It doesn't matter if I qualify. And that was that. We went home. So I don't know if she respected the principle or not. She was certainly shocked by it, I think. So much so she kept asking me the same question over and over again, like, if you just ask me more times and convince me that I could probably get it, maybe I'll just change my principles. You know, like, what was that guy's name? He was a comedian. I quoted him in that Principles and Character sermon. He said, these are my principles, and if they don't work, I have other ones, or something like that. But anyway. So if we hold to our principles, we will be recognized and promoted by men. It didn't work for me last week, but it does work in general. Don't worry about it. Trust me. And by the way, if you need to go to a hospital and you're a cash payer, go to Truman. Truman's way cheaper. They give you a 35% discount for being a cash payer right off the top. You don't have to pay the whole thing up front. They'll allow you to make payments on it if you need to and still get the cash discount. You go to Liberty, they charge you way, way more. They give you a pitiful little 15% discount if you pay the whole thing in cash right up front. Go to Truman if you're a self-payer. And the care there was just fine. It's a little ghetto, you know, but hey, it was good. So I recommend that place. All right, anyway, let's get to the second one here. Daniel was delivered from death in the lion's den. So we're going to fast forward here a little bit, and we're going to see that, you know, it said there that Daniel continued all this time until the first year of the king of Cyrus, or of King Cyrus. He was the king of the Medes and the Persians. He was the one that took over, that sacked Babylon and conquered it and became the king of it. And this was part of God's judgment of Babylon. It was conquered by Darius, the Median, and Cyrus, the Persian. Look in Daniel chapter 5, 30 through 31. Daniel 5, 30 through 31. It says, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And Darius and Cyrus were, as I understand it from, and I'm pretty well certain this is true, and maybe even could prove it to you in the Bible, I'd have to look. But anyway, they were regnums, or whatever they call that. They were both kings. One was a Mede, one was a Persian. They conquered that together. But anyway, because of Daniel's wisdom, faithfulness, and good reputation, he was made ruler over the entire realm of the Medes and Persians, including 120 princes and two other presidents. And he was made this by King Darius. Daniel 6, 1 through 3. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents. Let me say that again with different intonation. And over these three presidents. So you got 120 princes, and then over the 120 princes, you have three presidents. Okay? Different system than we have here, obviously. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. So he was the chief president in charge of the other two. That the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So Daniel is essentially like Joseph was. Remember, Joseph was only in the throne, or however the Pharaoh said it, was below the Pharaoh. Basically, the Pharaoh was in charge, but really Joseph was number two, and he was in charge of the whole land. And this is what Daniel was. He was over all these other presidents and princes. This is what happens when you're diligent in your business. Remember Proverbs 22:29. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men. Daniel is such a man of good character, such a role model for all of us to follow. He was wise, he was smart, he was diligent, he was hardworking, and he had principles and convictions. He was godly. There is pretty much none in the Bible better than Daniel, except for the Lord Jesus Christ. I don't know of any in the Bible that are better than Daniel, in my book anyway. Now, because of his favor with the king, he was envied by the presidents and princes who sought to find occasion against him concerning his work in the kingdom. Daniel 6 and verse 4, the first part. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. They don't like him, so they're going to see if they can find an occasion against him concerning the kingdom, concerning his work that he's doing in the government. Surely he's probably cut some corners. He's probably taken some bribes, right? There's probably some lobbyist there that's taken him on a nice, you know, plane trip down to the Caribbean or something and had a nice cruise down there or something. There's probably something going on here that we can get him with. He's probably done something dishonest. He's cut some corners. Somewhere we'll find something. Well, this is typical. People are going to envy those who do good work. Look in Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 4. Of course, Daniel didn't do anything wrong. They just hated him because he was better than they were. He was over them, and they wanted to get rid of him. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 4. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. Every right work, every man that does his work right, that does the right thing, for that he's envied of his neighbor. His neighbor sees him doing the right thing, being blessed for it, being promoted for it, and he hates him. He's not happy for him. He doesn't aspire to be like him. He hates him for it and tries to destroy him. That's what envy is. That's what envy does. Men hate those who are better and more righteous than themselves. This is our fallen nature. Look at Mark 15 and verse 10. This is why they delivered the Lord Jesus Christ up to be crucified. He didn't do anything wrong. They had to suborn witnesses. They had to make stuff up. They had to falsely accuse him to try to get him executed. It's because they hated him. It's because he was perfect and righteous, and he condemned their wickedness and their hypocrisy, and they despised him for it. Mark 15 and verse 10. For he knew, this is Pilate, for he knew that the chief priests had delivered him, that is Jesus, for envy. Pilate recognized what was going on there. And Pilate, because he was a little spineless politician, went along with it and didn't do anything to stop it, though he gave it a half-hearted old college try. Envy is one of the most injurious things a man can suffer. Proverbs 27 and verse 4. Wrath is bad, anger is bad, you get somebody that's got an explosive temper, that's bad. You don't want to be around that guy. You don't certainly don't want to be the object of his wrath. But I'll tell you what's worse, having somebody envy you. Because the guy that's mad and angry and outrageous, you know when he's mad. And you know who he is, you know what he's trying to do to you, you know when to duck when he throws something. The guy that's envious, though, it's all in his heart and you don't know it. And it's just seething and boiling inside there. And he's thinking of seven ways from Sunday how he can destroy you. And you don't even realize it. Very dangerous. Proverbs 27 and verse 4. Wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous. But who is able to stand before envy? Envy almost got Daniel killed. Would have if it wouldn't have been for the grace and mercy of God. Envy brought the Lord Jesus Christ to the cross. Who can stand before it? I mean, the Son of God couldn't stand before it. He subjected himself to it, obviously, but nevertheless. Well, the presidents and princes could find no fault or error in Daniel because he was faithful. Let's go back to Daniel 6 again, in the middle part of verse 4, or the second part of verse 4. Daniel 6 and verse 4. So they did some inquisition to try to find if they could find where he didn't even dot a T or cross an I. That didn't sound right. He didn't cross a T or dot an I. There we go. I knew I'd probably mess that one up. And they couldn't even find that. There was nothing. This guy was perfect and flawless. He probably even had a good oratory, I'll bet. Daniel 6 and verse 4, the second part. But they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Right there you have a definition of what faithful is. No error or fault. If you're faithful, you stick true to what you're supposed to do, whatever that is. He wasn't one of these, he wasn't a typical government employee. Lazy, do what, you know, whatever they possibly can to not have to do anything, cut corners, take bribes, you know, corrupt, whatever. That wasn't Daniel. Whatsoever he did it faithfully. Just give me one second. That just reminded me, that verbiage there reminded me of a verse, and I want to see if I can find it. I think I might be able to. I think it's in 2 John. It's in 3 John. 3 John 1 and verse 5. Oh, it's funny. It was right in the outline here in a minute anyway. I forgot to put it in there. I guess I'll give you that verse now since I already took you to it. 3 John 1 verses 5, 6, and 12. It says, Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers. So that's a good man. You do faithfully whatever you do. Whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, Paul tells us. Whatsoever thou doest, do it with all thy might, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. He did it faithfully to the brethren and to strangers, to people in the church or to people outside the church. He was faithful no matter what. Verse 6, which have borne witness of thy charity before the church, whom if thou bring forward on their journey after a godly sort, thou shalt do well. And then verse 12, Demetrius hath a good report of all men and of the truth itself, yea, and we also bear record, and ye know that our record is true. Now that's a good report. When you got a good report of all men and of the truth itself bears witness that you are a faithful man. That is really something to be said of a person, isn't it? That was Daniel. Now look at 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7. We're going to see that Daniel had a good report of them that were without, that was outside of the faith, outside of his nation of Israel, who were God's people at that time. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7. This is one of the requirements for a pastor. If a pastor is looking at a man to ordain to be a pastor of a church, this is one of the things that the man must have. It says, moreover, he must have a good report of them that are which are without, lest he fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. So a potential pastor has to have a good report of people that are outside the church. My brother was just telling me that he was talking with a Mennonite the other day, and he was asking him about their faith. He didn't know much about the Mennonite faith, and he was telling him how they get pastors in the Mennonite church, and they have a bit of a different way of going about it. It's not exactly scriptural. It's partly scriptural, partly not. But one of the things they do is based on this verse. They take a man, and they go and they talk to his neighbors, and they find out what kind of guy this is. And they ask the neighbors, is this a good man? Is he an honest man? Is he a just man? Is he diligent? Is he hardworking? Is he faithful? And if the neighbors say this is a good man, then he's met that qualification. Because, you know, I hate to tell you, this may be a big shock to you, there are hypocrites in the church, in churches, you know, that pretend that they're something that they're not. Their neighbors know what they are. You might not. You don't see them every day. You see them in church once a week, and everybody puts on their good face. But their neighbors know what a shyster they are. Be a good idea to talk to their neighbors, see what they say about them. So Daniel had a good report of them there without. And Daniel also had a good name, which is exceedingly valuable. Proverbs 22 and verse 1. Proverbs 22 and verse 1. It says, a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. If you could have great riches, I don't know, say $1 billion. Let's make it some real money here. You could have $1 billion. You could buy anything that your heart till your heart's content. You'd never run out. Would you rather have that? Or would you rather have somebody be able to walk up to your neighbor and say, hey, tell me about this guy. What's he like? And he says, this guy's a good man. Faithful, honest, diligent, totally trustworthy, good, godly man. Would you take $1 billion or would you take the good name? Think about it. You're going to have to work about as hard for that good name as you would for $1 billion. You know that, right? That good name doesn't just come. Oh, I was born a such and such, and therefore I've got a good name. No, you don't have a good name because you inherited it from your father. You have a good name because you earned it. And it takes a long time. And it only takes one screw up to remove that good name from you as well. Look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death and the day of one's birth. You know, precious ointment's expensive. I think of that ointment that lady Mary, it was Mary, that anointed Jesus' feet with that ointment, and they said it could have been sold and given to the poor, sold for, I think it was 300 pence. Well, you remember the parable where the man went and he hired laborers to labor in his field and he promised them a penny a day for an entire day's work? In the Bible, a pence is a penny, right, or plural of penny. 300 pence, 300 pennies, 300 days, 300 wages for a day's labor. A lot of money, right? Precious ointment. Well, Solomon says a good name's better than that. Well, back to Daniel. His enemies realized that if they were going to find anything to accuse him of, it was going to have to be something concerning the law of his God that put him at odds with the law of the land. They couldn't find anything in his work. He was pretty well flawless there, so they thought, well, we'll get digging around in his religion and we'll find something in his religion that we can make a law against. and then we can get him in trouble for his religion. Because we know this Daniel. Daniel doesn't compromise. And we know that if we make a law which says Daniel can't practice his religion anymore, Daniel's not going to cower in fear like the rest of these worthless people. Daniel's going to boldly serve God anyway. And we'll get him. It'll be really easy. And that's what they did. Verse 5. Daniel 6 and verse 5. Then said these men, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Your religion's a dangerous thing. It can get you into a lot of trouble. Get you into a lot of trouble. A lot of people, you can get on somebody's bad side because of your religion. Daniel was not going to suffer because he was a sinner or a criminal, but because he was a faithful follower of God. And when you suffer like that, you're blessed. 1 Peter 4, 14 through 16. 1 Peter 4, 14 through 16. First Peter 4, 14 through 16. "If you be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, you're blessed. For the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he's evil spoken of, but on your part he's glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Yet if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf." This is what Daniel was going to suffer for, not for being a murderer or a thief or an embezzler or an extorter, or, you know, any other things that most politicians probably are. Daniel wasn't going to suffer for that. He was going to suffer for being a Christian. And I'm using that term slightly loosely here. I know there weren't Christians by name back then, but he was a Christian in spirit, we'll put it that way. He was a follower of the true God back then. And when a man suffers for righteousness, he's blessed and he's acceptable with God. Just turn over a page or so to 1 Peter chapter 2. Actually, in my Bible, you don't even need to turn over. Just look over. 1 Peter 2, 19 through 20. "For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if, when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently?" What glory is that? You did something wrong, you went out and stole something, and then the magistrate lays you down and lays some stripes on your back. And then you think, "Boy, I suffered that so patiently, the Lord is going to bless me. I didn't even scream, I didn't even cry, I just sit there and took it like a man." Well, you deserved it! There's no blessing in that. "But if, when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God." See, Daniel, his suffering was going to be acceptable with God because he was suffering for well-doing, not for evil-doing. "Well, the men then conspired to convince the king to make a decree that for 30 days anyone who would make any petition to any god or man except the king would be cast into the den of lions." That phrase, "cast into the lake of fire," just was jumping into my mind there. "He'd be cast into the den of lions." The outline says could, I meant would, so you can correct that if you want. It's not that he could be, he would be cast into the den of lions. Daniel 6 through 7. "Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king, and saith unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdoms, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions." I'm sure this sounded pretty good to the king. "You know, king, we've come up with this ordinance because we love you so much, and we want to see you honored. We've come up with this ordinance that nobody in the kingdom for a whole month can make any petition, any prayer." That's what a prayer is a petition. "Nobody can make any prayer to any god or man except for you, king, for this whole month." King thought that sounded pretty good. What these guys are doing is they're framing mischief by a law. See, the king's too dense to realize what they're up to. Any king that had any sense should have realized, "Oh, wait a minute, why, why are you making this law again? You want everybody to pray to me for a month? And this sounds kind of strange, kind of, you know, too good to be true. The king's not all that bright, apparently. Anyway, Psalm 94 and verse 20, they're framing mischief by a law. They're trying to cause somebody to be punished by making a law against something that is not unlawful. People do this, you know. Psalm 94 and verse 20, shall the throne of iniquity have fellowship with thee, which frameth mischief by a law? There's all kinds of mischief that are framed by laws, forcing people to inject themselves with some gene therapy that they don't want, right? That's framing mischief by a law, forcing you to do that or get fired from your job, right? Mischief by a law. There's all kinds of examples of that today. These wicked men were using flattery to coerce the king into signing the decree. Psalm 5 and verse 9, this is what the wicked do. Watch out for anybody that is singing your praises, saying things about you that probably are a little bit over the top. They're probably setting a net for your feet. We'll look at that verse here next. Psalm 5 and verse 9, for there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat is an open sepulcher. They flatter with their tongue. You may recognize part of that verse there. Their throat is an open sepulcher. That's quoted by Paul in Romans chapter 3, referring to how all men are under sin. This is talking about the natural man here. The natural man, there's no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat's an open sepulcher, and they flatter with their tongue. Watch out for the person that flatters you, that says great things about you, that builds you up, puffs you up, tells you how great you are and how wonderful you are. A lot of people love that kind of stuff. A lot of people feed on that kind of stuff. And if you're one of those people that feed on all those praises and compliments, you will be very easily deceived. Somebody was telling me the other day they have an employee that works for them. And this guy, he's older. He's probably in his 60s, I guess. But a very immature character. And to keep him going, what the boss, the owner of the company, has to do is just constantly tell him what a good job he's doing, how wonderful he is, we couldn't do it without you, and that he loves that. That keeps him going. To me, if somebody told me that, yeah, you're doing a good job, okay, that's great. You tell me that more than once, I'm going to start to wonder. You tell me that we couldn't survive without you here, I'm going to be calling BS. That wouldn't work for me at all. You start puffing me up and telling me how wonderful I am, what a great job I'm doing all the time, I'm going to be watching you like a hawk because you're probably spreading a net for my feet. But this guy, and there's nothing evil going on here. This is what he has to say to the guy to keep the guy happy so that he stays, because he really does need him to stay. Very immature. A man of not much character there. If you have to be constantly praised, told what a wonderful job you do, just to keep you doing your job. But anyway, a wise businessman, a wise manager, will figure out who his people are, and he'll figure out who those kind of people are, and he'll just lay it on thick and just tell him what a wonderful guy he is and how much he needs him and how great of a job he's doing. You just got to figure out who your people are, that's all. Treat them accordingly. Now, having all men come to him, that is, to the king, with their petitions instead of God, would make the king feel pretty special. I mean, this is really feeding his ego here. Like, wow, I mean, I got all the people in the kingdom for 30 days. I'm going to have a line out my castle here, and they're all going to be coming to me with all of their petitions and their requests, and they can't even talk to God about it. Well, that sounds pretty good. It sounds horrifying to me if you're an introvert, but, you know, some people might like that. They were spreading a net for the king to catch him and get him into a situation that he couldn't get himself out of. Proverbs 29 and verse 5. Proverbs 29 and verse 5. It says, a man that flattereth his neighbor spreadeth a net for his feet. That is, for the neighbor's feet. I remember somebody tried to tell me one time that talking about spreading a net for his own feet, but that's not what that's... Yeah, you are spreading a net for your own feet. I guess you're going to harm yourself, but that's not what it's talking about. The guy that flatters is spreading a net for the neighbor's feet. He's trying to catch the neighbor. Like I said, it's really easy to deceive somebody if they are one that takes kindly to flattery. So these men used a flaw in the law of the Medes and the Persians, which stated that a law could not be altered once enacted, to ensure that the king could not go back on his decree once he signed it. Look at Daniel chapter 6 again. We're going to look, it says it three times. This was a well-known principle of the law of the Medes and the Persians. It could not be altered. Now, I don't know who came up with that boneheaded idea. What a horrible idea that you'd have a law code that once you passed a law, it could never be changed. That's an absolutely horrifying idea, but that's what they had. And this is what evil men will do. They'll find a flaw in the law, something, a loophole that they can exploit and then get somebody in trouble because somebody, you know, the lawmakers, when they passed it, probably never even thought of that scenario. But you can use that law. You can, you know, they pass some law and making some dodo bird an endangered species or something, and you can't destroy its habitat. And then all of a sudden, some farmer out there that tried to cut down a tree so that he could expand his field a little bit, and there was a dodo bird nest in that field or something, and now he's broken the federal law, and now he's going to the federal pen, and of course, these idiot congressmen that passed a law like that probably didn't think of old Joe Schmo the farmer out there. They were probably thinking about some greedy big business fat cat that was going to mow down the rainforest or something, right? So that's what happens. Anyway, Daniel 6, 8, 12, and 15. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. And then verse 12, he says it again, just the end of the verse. According to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. And verse 15, middle of the verse, that the law of the Medes and the Persians is that no decree or statute which the king establisheth may be changed. Now, if you were a king under such a system, you better be very, very careful what you sign, right? You don't sign laws that, unless you're 100% certain that this is a good law. But this guy wasn't thinking. All he was thinking about was having all men in the empire bow down and pray to him for 30 days. So the king foolishly signs the decree, Daniel 6 and verse 9. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. There's a lesson in that. This isn't even in the lessons. Read things before you sign them, especially if they're anything important. Read them before you sign them. Know what you're signing. It says in Proverbs 19 and verse 2 that to be without knowledge is not good, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. The king was without knowledge, wasn't even thinking, didn't even think about Daniel, and he loved Daniel. Didn't even think about this affecting Daniel. He was without knowledge, and he hasted with his feet. He just signed that thing because it sounded good. You want to be really careful about that. Don't make decisions hastily. Mark my words, you make a decision in haste, it is a bad decision, almost every time. I've just got to do it right now. I've got to do this right now. Whatever it is, it's going to be a bad decision, almost guaranteed. Take your time. Slow down. That's why I would never want to buy a house in this market, generally speaking. Because, I don't know, maybe it's slowing down a little bit now. But it was that pretty much houses are flying off the market. They don't even hardly get listed, and they're already gone. People were bidding on houses sight unseen, didn't even know anything about them. When you're doing that, you're going to probably get something that you didn't want to get. And that's why I don't want to buy a house. If I have to feel pressured that I've got to put in a bid in for this house or somebody else is going to get it, that means I'm in a bubble and the prices are too high. If you feel like you've got to jump on something, the prices are too high, you're in a bubble, wait. That's my advice anyway. It's just kind of, it's the natural mechanism that God has built into it. if you feel nervous that you've got to jump on things, something so fast, there's probably a reason you feel nervous about that. Stop. Wait. Wait a year. Wait 2 years. Wait 5 years if you have to. It'll be better for you. This was apparently a weakness among the Medo-Persian monarchs. I'm not going to read this verse in the interest of time. We'll actually probably get to it next week, I think. But you'll remember King Ahasuerus, they came up with, Haman came up with this plot that he was going to make this decree that these pesky people, he didn't bother to name who they were, but these pesky people throughout the empire, they got this weird religion, we just need to exterminate them. And the king just signs the decree. Didn't even think about it. It was the same thing. It was a decree that altereth not. Once you signed it, that was that. And thankfully he was able to give it another decree to tell the Jews to defend themselves, but he couldn't go back on the first decree. Well, when Daniel knew that the decree was signed, he went into his house and prayed toward Jerusalem with the windows open, just like he had always done. One of my favorite verses in the Bible, and you probably get tired of hearing me say about my favorite verse in the Bible because I got so many of them. But for this particular point, this is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house and hid in the closet, closed the windows, make sure nobody saw him, cowered in fear. He went into his house, his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled down, kneeled upon his knees below the ledge of the window so nobody could see him. He got really down, really low, so nobody would see what he was doing. Is that what it says? He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Underline those 4 words if you want to. I have. As he did aforetime. Daniel did the same thing that he had always done. It didn't matter if there was a decree signed. It didn't matter if it was illegal. It didn't matter if the penalty was death. It didn't matter if he could go to jail. Nothing mattered. It didn't matter if the police were going to come knocking on his door because he was breaking the law. He was worshiping God according to God's commandments. He didn't care. He just did what he always did. He kept going to church when the government said you can't, in other words. That's what he did. Acts 5 and verse 29, another one of my favorites. When Peter was told that he could not preach in the name of Jesus anymore, you know what Peter said? Well, you do what you got to do, but we got to obey God rather than men. That's a paraphrase. Acts 5 and verse 29, then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. And I realize over the last 2 years, you've heard this verse a million times, and I get on soapboxes in my ministry, and I've got different issues that I harp on, and I'll spend a year or two harping on various issues. Well, guess what? This is the one for now, and you're going to hear about it for a while. Daniel didn't protest the evil law in the street or intentionally make himself a target. Now, what he didn't, so there are two extremes. He could have gone into his house and closed the windows and got in his closet and secretly worshipped God and then salved his conscience by saying, well, I'm still praying, you know, I'm still doing what God said, right? He could have done that. Or he could have done the other extreme, and he could have walked right up to the king and said, you know what, watch this, king, and got down on his knees and prayed toward Jerusalem to God. He could have done that too. Wouldn't have been wise. He didn't need to do that. Just do what you've always done. You don't need to sound a trumpet. You don't need to make a big deal about it. Just keep doing what you've always done. That's what Daniel did. He didn't protest. He didn't make himself a target on purpose. But he also did not stop doing what God had commanded him to do. He didn't stop praying to God while the decree was in force. Neither did he go hide himself somewhere secretly to pray. He just kept doing what he always had done. Just like we did in 2020. We kept having church. We didn't have masks in church. We didn't social distance in church. We didn't split up the congregation. We didn't do any of that stuff. We just simply did what we've always done. We did it in another location because we were not allowed to be here anymore by a private company telling us we're not allowed to be on their property, that's a different story than the government saying you can't worship God. When a private company says you can't meet in my building, that's their right. When the government says you can't meet for church, that's not their right. We just kept doing what we've always done. And that's what every church needs to do if we ever have another lockdown again. And nobody got sick. Nobody got sick. Nobody died. I mean, nobody here got COVID, I don't think, until after all that stuff, after all the restrictions were removed, and then a bunch of people got it. And still, we're all here. Nobody died. Nobody got seriously ill. Yeah, when you obey God, well, surprise, surprise, things work out okay. Well, when Daniel's enemies saw him praying in violation of the law, they reported him to the king. This is exactly what they were waiting for. They knew that this was going to happen. Daniel 6:11-13. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? So they go to the king and they ask this hypothetical. Hey, king, I just want to make sure. I'm pretty sure I remember. Didn't you sign this decree? It said that nobody can pray to any god or man except for you, right? You did sign that, right? The king says, oh, yeah. Yeah, sure did. The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. King's like, you're darn right I signed it. And the law of the Medes and the Persians says, I can't go back on it. So you guys want me to go back on that? Don't even think about it. I'm not going back on that. Law of the Medes and the Persians, I'm not allowed to go back on that. Just so you know. It's almost like the king wants that thing to stay in force because he likes this idea. Maybe he's thinking they're trying to talk him out of it. But he's like, no, no, law of the Medes and the Persians. Can't go back on this one. Then verse 13. See, they've set him up. They set a net for his feet. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah. Anytime somebody refers to you as that so-and-so, oh, that Chad, you know, there's going to be something bad that's going to be coming after that. That Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. See, they've set him up. They knew the king liked Daniel. And they knew when the king finds out what Daniel has done, the king is going to try to defend Daniel. So they head him off at the pass. They ask him about the decree. He affirms he signed the decree, and he affirms that it can't be rescinded, and now he's boxed in. There's no way that he can possibly get out of this. Then they tell him, oh, well, by the way, Daniel's been praying to his God. And then the king realizes, oh, man. This is what you call cunning craftiness. This is why when you're wise, when somebody comes to you with a hypothetical question, always think about it, and then, in many cases, ask the person, why are you asking this? Especially as a pastor. You know, somebody comes to you and says, you know, pastors, hypothetically, what if? When somebody asks me that, I'm going to say, why are you asking me that question? Because what they do is they're trying to spread a net for your feet. They posit this question, this what if, and maybe it's some kind of a parallel situation, and then you say, oh, I think that'd be okay. Oh, good, because I'm going to do thus and thus. You're like, well, wait a minute here. Now, you want to be really careful about that. The king was very displeased with himself and tried his hardest to deliver Daniel, but he was bound by the law of the Medes and the Persians, verses 14 and 15. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. He tried everything. Probably talked to every lawyer and every attorney in the entire realm. Is there anything that I can do here to get this law overturned? Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and the Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth shall may be changed. There's just nothing he can do. What he should have done, he's the king, he should have just executed all those guys right there. And then, you know, put Daniel in the lion's den and hopefully Daniel comes out all right. But he should have just killed those guys right there for setting up a godly man, framing mischief for Allah. But maybe he was so shocked by the whole situation he didn't think about that. He got his chance later. We'll see that in a minute. So the king was forced to order Daniel to be cast into the lion's den. But he trusted that Daniel's God would deliver him. This is really interesting. This is a pagan king, by the way. Daniel 6:16-17. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, Thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. What a horrifying thing to be cast into a den of lions. And I'm guessing they probably kept these lions hungry all the time. That was the purpose of the den of lions. To have lions tear you apart. Oh, I mean, that would be just a horrifying experience. I'm sure they were roaring in there and all kinds of stuff. It's not like somebody pointed this out to me one time a long time ago. You see in these kids' books where Daniel's in the lion's den, he's sitting there patting the lion on the head or whatever. I doubt it was like that. It was probably terrifying. You just see him pacing back and forth right in front of you, eyeing you, getting ready to pounce on you at any second. But he had no choice. There Daniel is in the lion's den. But notice what the king said there. He said in verse 16, Thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. You realize that this pagan king had more faith than a lot of Christians do today? This guy had so much faith in Daniel's God, it wasn't even his own God. He knew of Jehovah, apparently. And he had such faith that he knew that Daniel's God would save him. And a lot of us Christians today have a hard time believing that God is able to save us, temporally speaking. Well, the king went home and he couldn't sleep because he was worried about Daniel. And he went to the lion's den early in the morning to see if Daniel was still alive. Verses 18-20. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the lion's den. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? He apparently had a little bit of doubt, because he goes there and yells to Daniel and says, Hey, was he able? I mean, he's hoping. But, you know, I mean, he's a pagan king. What do you expect? I mean, it's not too bad, though, really. Well, God had sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths, we read, and robbed them of their prey, as the song says, because Daniel was innocent, verses 21 and 22. Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, I have done no hurt. Daniel recognized that God saved him because Daniel was faithful to him. Daniel did what God told him to do. Daniel trusted God to save him, and he did. You know, I was just thinking here a second ago when I said that the king knew of Jehovah. No doubt when King Darius took over from the Medes and from the Babylonians, no doubt he heard the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being cast into the burning fiery furnace, and the angel of the Lord saving them there, and Nebuchadnezzar saying that their God's the true God, none can save like that. I'm certain that Darius would have heard about that. Darius knew about the God of Daniel and believed that he was able to deliver. Well, the king ordered Daniel to be brought up out of the den, and he was unharmed because he believed in his God. Look at verse 23. This is a verse that ought to give you all comfort. Then was the king exceeding glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him because he believed in his God. He believed in his God. No manner of hurt, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Hair wasn't singed, smoke of the fire wasn't on them, their garment wasn't burned up. No manner of hurt. Same thing with Daniel. He believed in his God. When he went down into that den of lions, he just trusted that God would somehow intervene and deliver him. And he did. You know, we're told in Romans 10 and verse 13, a very common popular verse, "Whosoever calleth upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." Well, Daniel called upon his God. Daniel believed on his God, and he was saved. We're told in 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 20 that those who believe in the Lord will be established. 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 20. 2 Chronicles 20:20, "And they arose early in the morning and went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, Hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, believe in the Lord your God, so shall ye be established. Believe his prophets, so shall ye prosper." How important is belief in the true God? "He that cometh to God must believe that he is, and he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him." You believe in the Lord, and you will be established, which means you'll be made firm and stable. You're not going to be moved around and cast about with every wind of doctrine and sleight of men, whereby they lie in wait to deceive, and you're going to prosper. Well, the king commanded that the men who accused Daniel, along with their wives and children, be thrown into the lion's den, where they were brutally killed by the lions. The lions were extra hungry by that time. They'd gone a whole evening and night without eating. And then they get themselves a feast of these wicked men that tried to kill Daniel. Daniel 6 and verse 24. "And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den." Be horrifying. See, there are consequences for sin. And there are consequences for people's family members for sin. You screw up, don't be surprised when your children suffer for it. That's probably one of the lessons I'm going to get to here in a minute. You know, it says in Proverbs 26 and verse 27 that whoso diggeth the pit shall fall therein. Proverbs 26 and verse 27. There's a second part of that, and I don't remember what the second part is at the moment. Proverbs 26 and verse 27. "Whoso diggeth the pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him." This is what happened to these guys. Because remember, God's law is set up, and I've mentioned this probably in the last sermon, that God punishes people with the same punishment that they thought to do unto others. Jesus said, "Judge not that you be not judged." He's talking about hypocritical judgment there in Matthew 7 and verse 2. In Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 20, I'm not going to go to that verse in the interest of time because I think we just saw it last Sunday, if I remember right. But the Lord said that if a witness rises up against another in judgment, they make inquisition. And if they find that charge to be untrue, then the person that charged him would receive the punishment that he thought to do unto him, whether it was death or whatever it was. You can read about that in Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 20. And then in Esther 7 and verse 9, which we'll probably get to next week, I'm not going to read that either. You remember that story with Haman, when the king was really mad at Haman and he wanted to take care of him. And they said, "Well, here's this gallows that he built for Mordecai." And he says, "Hang him thereon." See, you get the punishment that you thought to do to somebody else. Remember that the next time you try to falsely accuse somebody. Hopefully you don't. That's a really bad thing because You'll get what was coming to them if you falsely accused them. And then King Darius made a decree extolling the God of Israel who had delivered Daniel, verses 25 through 28. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of King Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. That's a pretty powerful statement there, that decree. And by the way, that's part of the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. So that's in perpetuity, or was in perpetuity for that kingdom. Men would tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. I mean, this guy knew some theology. He's the living God. He's not some dead idol. He's steadfast forever, right? He's never going. He's always going to be faithful. He's never going to change. I am the Lord. I change not. The Lord says, His kingdom is that shall not be destroyed. There's a prophecy about that in Daniel chapter 2. The Lord of heaven would set up a kingdom which should never be destroyed. This king realized that God's kingdom was never going to end. God's church was never going to be destroyed. It was never going to be taken out of this earth. He knew more theology than Scofield did. And his dominion shall be even unto the end. There'll be praise in the church throughout all ages by Jesus Christ, world without end. Amen. This king knew a lot of theology. Now, there are some lessons that we can learn from this. 11 of them. Number one, if we are diligent and faithful, we will be exalted by God. It says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will exalt you in due time. Lesson number two, when men do well and are promoted, others will hate and envy them for it. That's what they did to Daniel. And, you know, that happens to us too. Some people just can't be happy for somebody else. Some people, when they see somebody else doing well, hates them for it and just longs and wishes for the day that something bad happens to them. Some people are like that. It's really sad. And so don't be surprised if it happens to you if you're on the receiving end of it. Lesson number three. We should live a life above reproach, so that if someone is going to accuse us of something, it will have to be a false accusation. That's what we should endeavor to do. Live your life in such a way that if you do have an enemy, and if they do try to get you in trouble, they have to make a false accusation against you. Live your life in that way. That's what Jesus Christ did. That's what Daniel did. That's why it's so dangerous to be a politician, because most of these guys have all kinds of skeletons in their closet, and because of that, they can be controlled very easily, because their enemies don't have to make a false accusation. They have to make a true accusation, and then these guys are held in bondage. Why do you think, it appears, why do you think that John Roberts has made so many horrible rulings on the Supreme Court bench? It's because that guy's compromised. I forget the name of the guy, but there's a man out there that has publicly accused him of going to Jeffrey Epstein's island and doing all the pedophilia stuff. And he has told John Roberts, sue me, I dare you. Go ahead, bring a lawsuit against me. Bring a libel lawsuit against me. A defamation of character lawsuit against me. Roberts won't do it. Why do you suppose that is? Lesson number four, if our enemies can make a legitimate fault, if our enemies can't find a legitimate fault in us, they will make something up or make a law that we cannot abide by because of our faith, like they did to Daniel. They'll either make it up like they tried to with Jesus Christ, or they'll make a law. And the law might be, Oh, you can't assemble for church anymore. You can't have more than 10 people assembling in your congregation because of a pandemic or whatever. They'll make a law and then wait for you to break it, and then they'll have something to accuse you of. And just be aware of that. It happens. If it happens, it happens. Don't worry about it, but just be aware that stuff like that happens. Lesson number 5. Never assume that because you are being faithful in living an upright life before God that you will not have enemies who will try to destroy you. In our naivete, we think, I'm a good Christian. You know, whether we are or not is another story. We often tell ourselves that anyway. But you think, well, I'm a good Christian. Well, I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not being dishonest. I'm not out there trying to screw anybody else. I'm not going to have enemies. Nobody's going to come after me because I'm just trying my best to live a good and godly life. I'm not doing anything that I know of that is wrong and contrary to God's law. Nobody's going to come after me. Why would they? Don't be so naive. Daniel did absolutely nothing wrong. Daniel provoked nobody. Daniel wasn't flaunting it. Daniel had no reason for him to be treated like that. And yet, they came after him anyway. Think it not strange concerning the fiery trials which are to try you. If some strange thing happen unto you, Peter said, it happens. Lesson number 6. Sometimes even good kings or good people in authority can be manipulated into harming the people of God. This, by what I'm reading here anyway, seemed like a pretty decent king. He was at least good to Daniel. I don't know what else he did, but he was favorable toward Daniel, and he was able to be manipulated to persecute Daniel. So just remember that, even if you do happen to think there's a good politician in office, which I would be very skeptical of that, but even if there was, even he could be manipulated to persecute the people of God. Lesson number 7. We must always obey God rather than men, regardless of the cost. Now, had God not decided to save Daniel, it would have cost him his life. In a very brutal death, a horrifying death. But Daniel was willing to go to that death just to simply obey God. You realize that in Daniel's mind, if he's like a lot of these other capitulating losers, he could have said, well, you know, I could just not pray for 30 days. I could just close my windows. I could just, you know, I mean, God, is God really going to care if I leave my windows open? Right? I could just hide, right? I could do that. But he wouldn't do that. He wouldn't capitulate. He wouldn't compromise at all, knowing that death awaited him. That is such a good example to us. Lesson number 8. If we are forbidden by law to worship God or practice our faith, we must do it anyway and not fear the consequences. It doesn't matter if it's a law. It doesn't matter. I mean, in 2020, they weren't laws anyway. They were decrees by Gary Zabarak, the Clay County Health Department czar, dictator, tyrant, whatever he is. They weren't even laws. But even if they do pass a law, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if they say you can't assemble, or you can't assemble with a certain amount of people, or you have to do this, you have to do that. All those laws are null and void. Those laws do not apply within these four walls. We are under the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And those laws, any laws that are contrary to his laws, do not apply. I mean, think about it. The church is, ministers are called ambassadors. Ambassadors serve in embassies, right? An embassy is a sovereign piece of soil in a foreign land. That building, that piece of land in that embassy, within those walls or those fences, that is the land. It belongs to the land of the foreign nation. And that foreign country, if you're over in Spain and Spain passes some law, whatever it is, when you're within the walls of that embassy, that law doesn't apply to you. You're not in Spain anymore. You're on U.S. government property when you're in that embassy. And it works the same way with the kingdom of Jesus Christ. This is the embassy of Jesus Christ in a foreign land, and their laws don't apply to us. Not if they're contrary to God's law. And that makes them mad. They don't like to hear that. Lesson number 9. When we are persecuted, we must believe that God is able to deliver us and that He will if it is His will. You always want to remember that. He's able and He will if it's His will. Don't presume on His will and say, I know that He will, because you don't know. Sometimes He lets you suffer for His own reasons and purposes. Lesson number 10. Our enemies will eventually reap what they sow and be judged by God. The men that tried to get Daniel into the lion's den got themselves there. Let me just give you a verse here, which will show us that our enemies, and we may have to wait, till the second coming, the people that have persecuted the saints, but I'll show you what happens to them. And I wouldn't want to be in their shoes. I'd rather be the persecuted than the persecutor. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 4. So that we ourselves glory in you in the churches of God for your patience, that's suffering with calmness and composure, in faith in all your persecutions and tribulations which ye endure, which is a manifest token of the righteous judgment of God, that ye may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God for which ye also suffer. Seeing it is a righteous thing which with God to recompense tribulation to them that trouble you. And to you who are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with His mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power, when He shall come to be glorified in His saints and to be admired in all them that believe, because our testimony among you is believed in that day. That's what happens to people that persecute the church, the saints. They will get what's coming to them. It may be at the second coming, but it's coming one day or another. And lastly, lesson number 11, if we are faithful during persecution, we can be a witness to those in high places and possibly affect their conversion. Daniel was faithful, and what did that do to Darius' faith in the true God? I mean, if his decree was spoken from the heart in sincerity, that man believed in the true God. Daniel had a profound effect on that man's faith and conversion. Think about Paul. Paul writes, and he says that they that are in Caesar's house salute you. There were believers, in other words, in Caesar's house. Paul, in house arrest in Rome, brought before Caesar in some tribunal, had an opportunity to preach the gospel to Caesar's house, and some of them were converted. We'll get to that later on in this series, Lord willing. So, that takes care of Daniel. Next time, we're going to go ahead in time, but back in Bible book order, back to the book of Esther, and we're going to see how the Jews were delivered from national destruction with Esther and Mordecai. May the Lord be with you until next week.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.